Chapter 16 of the Autobiography of Lord Alfred Douglas. This Legimus recording may be distributed and adapted freely for any purpose. Chapter 16. I suppose, after all, it is necessary to a complete comprehension of the case that I should fill in the gaps in the narrative contained in the last chapter. The story has been told so often that I'm apt to forget that many of my readers may not know it. What happened was that, after I'd known Wilde a few months, and had been about a great deal with him, my father suddenly one day spoke to me about it, and told me that Wilde was not a fit man for me to associate with. I must do my father the justice to say that at this stage he was not unkind or offensive, as he became afterwards. He light-heartedly told me that I must give up knowing Wilde, and seemed to think that this would be quite enough. Naturally, considering that in the first place I was of age and free to choose my own friends, and in the second place that my father had neglected me for years, in fact all my life, and had never shown more than the very slightest and most perfunctory interest in my doings, I ignored my father's instructions. I wrote to him and told him that I did not see any reason why I should give up my friend, and that I really could not think of such a thing. I wrote my father a perfectly respectful and affectionate letter, and begged him not to interfere. He replied, telling me that I was a fool and a baby, and that I did not understand what I was doing. The controversy began to get acrimonious, and my father had already begun to make threats of cutting off my allowance, when, one day, while I was lunching with Oscar at the Café Royal, upstairs, my father came in and sat at another table. I immediately went over to my father and asked him to come up and join Wilde and me for lunch. He refused at first, but I pressed him, and he said, "Very well," and came rather sulkily over to our table. I introduced them to each other. Oscar exerted himself to be agreeable. He was in good form, and in about 10 minutes he had my father laughing and listening eagerly to his conversation. The lunch was such a success that when they got on to Christianity, which was my father's bugbear, and therefore his favourite topic, he actually, a little while before this time, gave public lectures against Christianity, and he always described himself as an agnostic. Lunch was over, and they had got to the cigar and liqueur and coffee stage. In the end, I got bored and left them, at about 3 o'clock, still talking to each other and leaving me out. When I saw Oscar that evening, he informed me, with pardonable pride, that he had completely got round my father, that they were now great friends, and had arranged to meet again, and that the luncheon at the Café Royal had been prolonged till past 4 o'clock. I was, of course, delighted to hear this, and still more so when, 2 days later, I got a letter from my father saying that he wished to take back all he had said about Oscar Wilde, that he considered him a charming fellow and very clever, and that he did not wonder I was so fond of him. He went on to say that he had been told by his old friend, Lord de Grey, afterwards Lord Ripon, that Wilde was a friend of his and Lady de Grey's, and that he was perfectly all right in every way, besides being a man of genius and a most delightful and amusing talker. This pleasant state of affairs lasted, however, only about 2 months. One day I got another letter from my father, repeating his old accusations against Wilde, and requiring me, once for all, to give an undertaking, on my word of honour, not to see him or associate with him again. Failing this, my father told me that he would stop my allowance. I wrote back an angry letter, in which I said that I declined to do anything of the kind. I reminded my father of his neglect, and said that I did not consider that he had any right to interfere in my life, and I told him that if he was mean enough to stop my allowance, he could go ahead and do it, which he promptly did. I am not justifying my conduct, I am merely relating the facts. No doubt it would have been far better for me if I had obeyed my father. On the other hand, I am entitled to say, and in this I am supported by my mother and also by my uncle, my father's now sole surviving brother, the very Reverend Canon Lord Archibald Douglas, who is a Catholic priest, that the main responsibility for the trouble must rest with my father. His brutal treatment of my mother, his noisy repudiation of Christianity, which had resulted in his being practically turned out of the House of Lords, and the fact that he was himself living a notoriously immoral life, deprived him of what in other circumstances would have been his legitimate authority. Moreover, considering that such a short time before he had met and liked Wilde, and had actually written telling me that he withdrew his aspersions, and giving me full authority to go on with my friendship, I felt that he had, at any rate, no right whatever to adopt the threatening and bullying attitude which he had now taken up. I am the last person in the world who can be bullied or threatened into doing anything. In that respect, I very much resemble my father. Neither of us would give way. My father wrote to me in insulting terms. I replied in the same vein. And when he wrote to me his most outrageous letter of all, in which he made a perfectly untrue statement as to something which he alleged he had seen with his own eyes. Need I say that his letters have been used against me in the law courts over and over again? I sent him my celebrated telegram, "What a funny little man you are!" I did this deliberately as being what I considered the most effective way of hitting back at him. Harris, in his Life and Confessions of Oscar Wilde, says that I showed feminine ingenuity in devising such a telegram. This is exactly typical of Harris's spiteful methods, which, as a matter of fact, are far more feminine, in the bad sense, than mine have ever been. My father at that time, and indeed all his life, was a formidable person. He was a man who had established a reputation as a dangerous man, and one who would stick at nothing if he was roused. He was, at one time, amateur lightweight champion boxer. He had repeatedly threatened to thrash me if he found me in Wilde's company, and he went round to all the restaurants we frequented and warned the managers and maitre d'hotel that he intended to assault both Wilde and myself if he caught us together on their premises. When I heard this, I made a point of going regularly with Wilde to these very restaurants. I wrote more than once to my father and told him that on such and such a day, at such and such an hour, he would find us in such and such a restaurant, and I invited him to come round and see what happened to him if he started any of his ruffianly tricks. I see nothing feminine in this conduct. No doubt it was wrong of me to defy my father, but at any rate I question whether Harris himself, for all his ancient pistol truculence, would have had the pluck to do as much. Everyone in London was apparently afraid of my father, with the solitary exception of myself, for he was allowed to do such things which would have been tolerated in no one else, and no one ever had the courage to tackle him. To do Oscar Wilde justice, he showed plenty of spirit, and was not unduly intimidated by my father's threats. He was nervous, but he did not climb down or show the white feather. All through life I have found that persons who make threats of the thrashings they are going to give, and who warn other people about the terrible things they are going to do, are very unlikely to be really dangerous. If my father had really meant to assault me or Wilde in a restaurant, he would have done it first, and talked about it afterwards. I sent him the telegram I have quoted, precisely to show him that I treated his threats with utter contempt. No doubt it filled him with rage, but it had the result of convincing him that I was not disposed to be bluffed, and we heard no more about thrashings and chucking out of restaurants. In the various letters that my father sent me, he of course libelled Oscar Wilde quite sufficiently for Wilde to have taken proceedings against him long before he actually did. I am not, and never have been, at all ashamed of the fact that I urged Oscar from the very first to take proceedings. According to what were then my lights, I did right in doing so. I told him that he should go for my father at once. If he had done this, my father would not have had a leg to stand on. The evidence which my father got later took a long time to collect, and could not have been available at the time when he first started his attack. Curiously enough, in this as in other ways, history repeated itself when I went for Ross. If Ross had started proceedings against me directly after I first began libelling him, he would almost certainly have succeeded in squashing me. The climax came soon after the first night of Oscar's play, The Importance of Being Earnest, at the St. James's Theatre. My father went to the box office with a bunch of carrots in his hand, which he proposed to throw at Wilde when he appeared before the curtain at the end of the play. He was refused admission to the theatre. I was absent in Biskra when this happened, but on getting a letter from Oscar relating the incident as well as an account of the great success of the play, I rushed back to London. Shortly afterwards, my father left one of his cards at one of Oscar's clubs, the Albemarle, on which he had written the words, "Oscar Wilde posing as sodomite." On this, Oscar Wilde took action. In the book Oscar Wilde and Myself, which I wrote in collaboration with Crossland, there is, written by Crossland, an account of this episode which gives an entirely false account of my own actions at this moment. I am, of course, myself responsible for this mistake, because I asked Crossland to write this part of the book, feeling at the time so shaken and unnerved by the experiences I had been through at the Ransom trial that I felt I could not bring myself to write about it. Crossland wrote the story, and I read it and passed it. Not till after the book was published did I realise that what was written contained a grave blunder. It is stated in Oscar Wilde and Myself that I went with Wilde to Bow Street when he applied for a warrant for my father's arrest. This is not the case. I did not go with him, and what is more, I did not know till the day after it was done that he had at last actually started proceedings against my father. As a matter of fact, Robert Ross was at the time Wilde's adviser in the matter. It was Ross who induced Wilde to go to his, Ross's, solicitor, Mr. Humphreys, a charming man and an able solicitor, but the last solicitor in the world who would be useful to Wilde in such a juncture. Humphreys was a high-class family solicitor, and had, I believe, no experience in criminal matters. He knew nothing whatever about Oscar Wilde, of course. I mention all this not because I wish to evade responsibility for advising Oscar to proceed against my father. As I have already explained, I had advised him to do it long before. But it is important to record the fact that directly Oscar told me that he had got a warrant for my father's arrest, and that his solicitor was Humphreys, I said, "Why on earth didn't you go to George Lewis?" That, of course, was during the lifetime of the original George Lewis, the father of the late Sir George, Ross's great friend, who pursued me for so many years in the law courts. End of chapter 16.